Welcome to Intersection Live, the tax and accounting profession's premier podcast source. Provided by the CPA Technology Advisor at the intersection of technology and public accounting. The Intersection Live podcast series is brought to you by ADP Small Business Services, supporting the accountant community. This is Tech to Go, a monthly fast-paced roundtable discussion with executive editor Greg LaFollette and regular columnists Brent Goodfellow, Dave McClure, and Randy Johnston. These thought leaders tackle current technology issues impacting the tax and accounting profession.
This is Tech to Go, episode 22, Outlook Passwords, Tools and Browsers. Hello, Greg LaFollette, Intersection Live, Tech to Go, episode 22. We're recording today on October 21st, finally after busy season. We respect all of you tax practitioners who finally moved back into normal kind of schedules after suffering through the 15th. We've got the whole crew here this morning, and first signed on my friend up in the Pacific Northwest, Brent Goodfellow, with the technologist from I'm going to say this wrong, Brent. Beaverton is where you live, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, so in Hillsboro is where you office, right?
That's correct.
And Portland is what all the rest of us non-Pacific Northwesters would say.
That's right. It's all Portland to us.
It's all Portland to me. Well, welcome, Brent. For those regular listeners, you will recognize Brent. He's written a column now for probably 7 years or so for the CPA Technology Advisor, a very popular column. He's carries more Microsoft certifications than any human being that I've ever met, other than you, Brent. You're it. How many certifications are you carrying these days?
Well, actually, week before last, I just went and recertified on Windows Server 2008. That's the fourth time recertifying for me, and Microsoft has changed their certifications a little bit. I got a kick out of this because it's now called Microsoft Certified Information Technology Professional, so that's CITP with an M in front of it.
Okay, so a mobile CITP. That's interesting. So you've certified four times now on that server product. Let's see. I passed the CPA exam back in the early 70s, and I got to go back and count the times that I've recertified. Let's see. That would be there'd be none. and all I can say to that is thank God. So. Well, Brent, welcome, and again, thanks for joining us. Our East Coast representative dialed in this morning, David McClure. Life in your world, you said you're out of the office, but you're with us. I appreciate that. Welcome.
That's not a problem, and boy, we just had our first frost here in the valley of the Shenandoah River, and it's a little chilly here yet.
Well, you know, that's good. That'll keep out the riffraff. Well, so again, I appreciate you being here, and your column in the CPA Technology Advisor actually predates all of us. I think you were writing your column before I joined, Dave. Do you remember that?
Oh, sure. I mean, we're going on. This is coming up. Will be my 15th year writing for it.
Yeah, and I'm in. I think about 12 or so. So you've everything that we could say has already been said. Do you think that's true?
Yes, that's probably true. Because the technology keeps changing.
Exactly, it does, and I enjoy the stuff that you write about so much, and occasionally we'll talk, and I read it, and I go, oh, I disagree with everything this guy's saying, but But that's what makes it fun. And we've actually got some specific stuff that we're going to talk about, Dave, that I know you've got some real strong feelings on. So I'm looking forward to that. Our final, last but most certainly not least, regular Tech to Go guest, Randy Johnson, the Mr. Accounting Technology in the profession. Randy is most probably the most well-known speaker and technology consultant to the profession. See him, he is Mr. Ubiquitous when it comes to accounting technology events and things of interest to the people in our community. If it's something going on, Randy will either have a hand in it, be involved in it, be on the committee, be speaking, be there. You're always there, Randy. How do you do that?
You know, it's way too many frequent miles. But, you know, I'll have to admit, listening to the Brent and Dave backgrounds, I feel like a rookie.
Yeah, you're not a rookie. You've been doing this longer. You know, you're into right up to about 30 years now?
Actually, that's pretty close. I started actually in the 60s. So
okay.
I've been doing it for a while, but have not been writing for that long for publications. You know, I'd written books before that, but
right. It
really is a pleasure to spend the day with you guys.
Well, I distinctly remember coming to you after I took responsibility for the CPA Technology Advisor and sitting down with you, in fact, in Las Vegas at the ASCPA Tech Show, and we sat at a table and we each had out our brand new Trio 600s, and we drew a crowd of other technology folk all standing around looking at these cool new machines that we had. That wasn't very many years ago. As a result of that particular conversation, I came to you and asked if you would consider writing a column for us, and luckily for me and for all of our readers, you agreed to do that, and everything else is history. Great column and great content, and we certainly appreciate the time that you give us and the fact that you've been a stalwart member of the panel here at Tech to Go. It's again fun to have you.
Well, thank you very much.
So we have what I think are some interesting topics today. We're going to kind of give you as listeners just a little bit of a preview of some of the things that will be in the November issue of the CPA Technology Advisor. As I was reading through the final columns and approving all the content, making sure we got everything put together, it struck me how very interesting the columns are, especially from these three guys. And I said, you know, let's take some of the stuff that each of us are writing about and kind of bounce those ideas off the other participants here at Tech to Go and see how, you know, what the other ideas are. So I pulled some of those ideas from those columns, and that's what we're going to do this morning. Before we get into that, I want to remind our listeners that we do maintain a set of show notes for each one of our shows, and they're available at cpatechadvisor.com or cpata.com, and you can simply hit the podcast button and look for Tech to Go. You'll find this particular episode number 22, and just click on that. Up will pop the show notes. We will have any names or product names or websites or telephone numbers or anything like that we happen to mention going through. We will include those in the show notes, so you don't have to worry. You don't have to go back and re-listen and say exactly what was that website or anything like that. They're all there in the show notes. Now, in addition to that, we do record all of our Tech to Goes. We record live via TalkShoe, and occasionally we have guests. Occasionally we have people who just want to drop in and listen to us live, and we're certainly Always excited to see that. So if you do want to join us live, we will be recording episode number 23 on November 19th at 11:30 a.m. Eastern Time, 11:30 a.m. Eastern Time on Wednesday, November 19th. So if you want to pop in and join us there, we would certainly welcome you. So, without further ado, I want to move on to our first topic. Brent, you wrote about email management. You had some interesting ideas, I thought, about email management. And so I thought we'd start with that and let you kind of talk a little bit about what your ideas are on email management, and then we can get the rest of the panel to kind of respond to that. And I'll bet between the full group here, we've got some spirited discussion on what works and what doesn't work, and maybe the listeners will learn something, and maybe we'll get some good questions and comments that we can follow up on. So talk to us a little bit about email management, Brent.
Okay, happy to do that. As you know, we all use email significantly these days, probably one of our most used applications, maybe second to the browser, at least in my situation. And like a lot of us, I'm sure, I use Microsoft Outlook as my window to email, my personal information manager. And I think we need to underline the word personal, because how we each take care of the flow of email is a kind of a personal choice. In my case, I found myself kind of comparing my electronic inbox to my mailbox at home, and that's what I wrote about in the article. When I go to the mailbox once a day at home and I put the key in and open the box and take the mail out, I go back to the house. And I find myself going through this sorting routine. You know, I sort the junk mail out, and that gets tossed, and the magazines and newspapers, that kind of thing gets put in a separate stack for reading at a later time. You know, and then there's other things that we get, like, for example, we all get bills in the mail, and normally we don't take care of those bills immediately. They usually get stuffed in a folder, and we deal with them once a month. For example, or maybe a little more often than that. And so I started thinking about that and how we do our inbox in our mail management program, whatever it is. In my case, it's Outlook. I have seen inboxes just in working with clients that have literally tens of thousands of messages in the inbox. And it just was amazing to me that you could have 10,000 or more messages in your inbox, which most of those messages have somehow been dealt with, and yet there they sit. And so in my case, I just decided to come up with a technique that I could use to organize the mail which flows into my inbox. And the way I do that is I created four folders, subfolders, I guess, of the inbox, and I call these four folders requires action, possible action, read and review, and then I've got, of course, the inbox. And so what I do when I look at my flow of email, let's say first thing in the morning, the items that I can deal with quickly and the items that are important and urgent, I'll go ahead and deal with those immediately. The items that contain attachments that require reading that aren't urgent but may be important, I stick those in my read and review folder. And then items that I can do at a later time, so like my bills at home, for example, that I can deal with at a later time, I actually open a separate copy of my calendar and I activate the taskbar in Outlook, and I actually just drag the email to a day on my calendar when it looks like I'm going to have time to deal with that issue. And so that issue then gets filed into the requires action folder, and I know that I'm going to deal with it. I've already scheduled it for a day, and then, of course, I have all the information right on my calendar. So each day I take a look at my calendar, I look at all of those emails that have been converted to tasks, and then plan my day accordingly.
Okay, Brent, we just had about 1,000 listeners pop up their heads and say, "What do you mean a separate calendar?"
Well, when I say separate calendar, if I'm looking at the calendar icon in Outlook, I can actually right click on that calendar icon in the navigation bar, and I can select Open in a New Window. And I think, like a lot of practicing accountants, I have multiple monitors, and so I have my calendar on one monitor, and I have my inbox on the other. If you activate the taskbar, then you can just drag emails right onto that taskbar for a particular
day.
And that's how I schedule emails that come in. Most emails require some sort of action. It's just a question of timing, you know, whether they need to happen immediately or sometime in the future.
Okay. Well, I'm gonna be not too proud to tell you that until this very moment, I didn't know I could do that. I did not understand. I run Outlook on a separate monitor. I have dual monitors in my setup, and I actually use my laptop to show Outlook. But I didn't understand that I could basically have multiple views of Outlook. So I learned something, and I appreciate that.
Well, you're just like Socrates, who said, "I am still learning," later in his life.
Well, no, I'm not just like Socrates, but I certainly am learning. So, Brent, now you said you set up separate subfolders under your as children of your inbox. Explain to me why you would do it that way rather than setting it up as a folder at the same level as the inbox, just as a subfolder of the general mailbox.
Well, you know, you could certainly do that, and that's why I just want to stress that this is just a matter of personal choice. In my way of thinking, I just felt like these were all pieces of mail that came into my inbox, as with, I suppose, all of our folders are, but I wanted to keep it all as part of my inbox, so to speak, and that was just kind of a personal choice.
Okay, but from a technology point of view, are there pluses or minuses to having a folder at the same level as the inbox or as a part of the inbox?
No, there really aren't. At least I'm not aware that they are. And with Outlook, you know, you have this concept of favorite folders. So, you know, if wherever these live, if you add them to your favorite folders, it doesn't really matter where they are in the tree.
Sure, because those are just almost like hot links to that particular folder. In fact, no matter how deep it is, and I have some that I've now because I tend to use Outlook almost as a document management tool, which I think an awful lot of accountants end up doing, and we probably overuse it for that. But I end up with subfolders that are actually quite deep. I have to drill a fair amount down to occasionally get things there. So, any other kinds of ideas, Brent? There's a lot of tools and rules and things that you can apply in Outlook. Do you use some of those things?
Yeah, I actually do. I have applied rules to certain emails so that certain emails get automatically moved to folders, so to speak. And that's fine, although really what that means is that if an email gets automatically moved as a result of a rule, then you have to go to that folder that you've set the rule for, and then you have to maybe schedule a task from there. And so what I've found is that I've eliminated a lot of my rules because so much of our email actually turns into some sort of an action item, some sort of a task. Whether it's reading or accomplishing a task associated with it.
Sure. So, Dave, are you an Outlook user, or how do you manage email?
Oh, I've been an Outlook user for, gosh, more than a decade now, easily.
Okay.
And the thing I'm very aware of, and I think most accountants need to be aware of as well, is those 10 or 20,000 emails that you're keeping in your Outlook or on your server are a lawsuit waiting to happen. Because if you go into court for any reason, the first thing the lawyer will do right now is immediately put a clamp on all your emails so that they can search through them looking for evidence against you. So unless you are, for example, Sarah Palin, who's under a court order not to delete her emails, I make it a policy to save nothing more than 90 days that isn't required under the law. Nothing.
Okay. Interesting approach. I'm not sure. I'm sure I don't agree with that. But for different reasons.
Once again,
than,
Greg, you and I disagree.
Yeah. Absolutely. So, Randy, cast a deciding vote there.
Well, I'm not sure it'll be a deciding vote because I think it might wind up 2-2. You know, typically, two or three comments along this line. Number one, for the firms that are further along in document management, basically, you know, the comment about not keeping anything in Outlook really lines up with where the firms are at. In other words, if a email message comes in, if it really needs to be retained, it's dropped into the document management system, so it becomes part of the records retention policy and available to everyone that way, and it's removed from the email system. So we have a lot of CPA firms now and a lot of industry businesses that actually have rules to delete any email older than, let's say, 3 weeks or 2 weeks. So there is absolutely nothing that's, you know, stored historically in Exchange and Outlook. Now, the other extreme, of course, are the users that have the, you know, file cabinets that have everything that was ever created electronically in Exchange and Outlook, all messages, all filed away, and so forth. So, you know, in Brett's basic approach of, you know, having the subfolders for action and so forth, you know, I actually use a similar type of strategy simply because of the volume of email that I'm dealing with. But reality is the long-term archival things, I try to get them out of Outlook as soon as I can and into some sort of permanent retention approach.
So let me ask you guys this. For practitioners who live in what I would call substantial firms. This is firms of probably certainly 8 or 10 or more. They live in kind of a different world because they oftentimes have the professional infrastructure, and they can have it becomes much easier for those practitioners to say, this is personal, that's professional. What I find so often in the very small firms, the twos and threes, and remember that's somewhere over 80% are like under 4 and 90% are under 10. So our listeners are by and large those practitioners from small firms, and their personal life and their professional life is all mixed up. Their calendar includes the kids' soccer game and the church social and the society meeting and a golf outing and a client meeting. Everything is involved, personal and professional. Does that change? That's the way they live. Maybe they shouldn't live that way, but I think that's the way they live. Does that change any of your opinions?
Well, I can jump in first here. I've had a personal email address for years. You know, I've got a Gmail address and a Hotmail address and that kind of thing. And I just found that it was just too difficult to try and manage all those different email addresses. And with Outlook, you know, you can add Hotmail addresses, for example, and you can add Gmail addresses into Outlook. And that might be a good strategy. For me, I just would like all of my mail to flow into one spot. It's just an easier way to deal with it, whether it's personal or business related. And with Outlook, I just feel like I can have a better control over the amount of information that's flowing to me, both professionally and personally. The other thing I wanted to just quickly say is that we have document management here in the firm as well, and I didn't mention that, but we do the exact same thing that Randy mentioned. Anything that is of a client nature that needs to be preserved and accessible to others, we can stuff those emails directly into document management. That doesn't change my technique for getting a task accomplished, but the information itself does eventually get into our document management system also.
And see, that makes beautiful sense. And I've done a similar thing to you, Britt. I've actually managed my email accounts separately with separate profiles, and it was just too painful, honestly, because as many of the listeners may know, I have an infrastructure business, Network Management Group, and I have a seminar business, K2, and of course I have a personal life and I have a few other connections like that, and it really was notably simpler to have all of those emails and all of those calendar events flow into a single source. And of course I'm using some naming conventions to separate, you know, K2 versus NMGI, and we might, you know, go a little bit further and personal. So when you look at my calendar, which is color-coded, the personal items are always in green, and you can see that. And time-critical things are always coded in red. And I do that all with auto-filters, so I don't really touch anything. And my travel is always in purple, and my K2 events are always in yellow, and my NMGI events are always in orange. So I can visually see on my calendar immediately that I've got something where I physically have to be somewhere, a meeting or a conference call, or that I'm doing a K2 seminar, or that I'm doing NMGI consulting.
Yeah, the colors are great in Outlook, and I employ the same technique as far as color coding, you know, personal events versus professional events, that kind of thing.
Right. One of the things, and I like the color coding. I actually automatically attach color coding to incoming emails. There are certain people in my life that I communicate with a lot. And I want to be able to see very quickly as I scan. I mean, I open my email after being, if I'm in a conference all day long and I haven't looked at my email, but I'll open it. I can easily have 50 emails, and I don't get spam. So these are emails that I have to deal with. What I've done is color code these. So I color code stuff from my publisher. I color code stuff from my managing editor. I color code stuff from my wife. So when I look, I can look down all of those, and they're automatically marked, and I can see what they are right away. So that tends to work for me. I also set up a separate folder for example, for my managing editor, because there's so many things that we work on together. I set up a folder so that every email I receive from her or send to her, I move a copy of that email into a separate folder. And not the original, but just a copy of it. The original I then deal with and put in its own act, like it's action folder or an activity folder or something like that. But I do know that I've got that one spot, and I suppose that's maybe a little bit of overkill, but that's the way it works.
Well, that's why they call it a personal information manager, right?
I guess so. So in terms of managing this email behemoth that you end up with, you've got 10,000 emails, whether they're in one mailbox or one folder in your inbox, or whether they're carefully organized into all kinds of folders, when you need to go find them, VistaSearch, Brent, is that the way you go, or?
Yeah, I use the new indexed search that is built into Vista and Outlook,
and I've
found that as a result of that, you know, the whole idea of folders uh, takes on less meaning for me
because of
the effectiveness of the search.
That is true. But I use folders. For example, I have a separate folder for every physical trip that I take, and each item relative to that trip goes into that folder. And many times something relative to the trip ends up in that folder, but I wouldn't have been able to find it unless I, you know, because it wouldn't necessarily say, you know, Phoenix, October 2008 might not be anywhere in the body or the subject of that particular message, but it's still related to the fact that I'm today sitting in Phoenix.
Yeah, and I do the same thing. You know, I do the same thing with projects. You know, so a particular project that I'm working on, you know, all the emails associated with that eventually end up in that project folder, that kind of thing.
Sure. Okay, so final thing to kind of wrap up the email thing. Any of you guys use the Zobni add-in?
Yeah, I've got it installed. I'm not so sure. It kind of seems like a solution looking for a problem just a little bit, although there's some neat things. There's some neat technology things that they've built into it, and I think it has real potential.
Okay. Zobni is actually inbox spelled backwards, right? X-O-B-N-I?
Yep.
The story was that Microsoft tried to buy them, and these guys turned it down. Is that true, Brent?
You know, that could be. I don't have any firm knowledge of that. Microsoft, you know, tries to buy these little outfits all the time for the
sure.
technology itself. And these guys are out of San Francisco, and so it wouldn't surprise me at all that they drew some interest from Microsoft. I know that Gates, I think at a recent developer conference, I think he mentioned this in his speech. So it was certainly on their radar screen.
Sure, sure. Any of you other guys, Randy or Dave, have you looked at that Zobni product?
I have, and in fact, I've been in clients in the last couple of weeks using the product, and we talked about it as a new add-in to discuss during our Outlook teaching during this fall section.
Uh-huh.
So, again, it's a little bit of an extension. I'm not sure it is has enough benefit that having an extra piece of software in there is the thing to do.
Right.
And I agree with that. I agree with that. I've looked at it. I've installed it. But I don't see that it has a lot of practical value for me.
Yeah. It does some interesting things. And, you know, I'm kind of like you guys. I do have it installed. I look at it every once in a while. I use it. But I end up, if I do a search, the Vista built-in search is so good that I'm not sure the Zobni does it, certainly doesn't do it any better, but it certainly does it differently. It's got just a kind of a different way of looking at it. So, for the listeners, it's free. Go to Zobni.com and take a look at it. And if it works for you, it doesn't seem to be a big overhead user or anything. So it might be something to take a look at. So, Brent, thanks for the email stuff. Your column actually goes into more detail on some of those ideas. So I'd encourage everybody to take a look at that when the November issue hits your desk. I wanted to talk a little bit about password management, and it was interesting, Dave, that you mentioned Sarah Palin's Yahoo email account. I was visiting last night. I had dinner, Randy, with one of your colleagues, Brian Tankersley from K2, and we were visiting about this. And of course, he lives in Knoxville, the home of the young man who actually, quote, hacked Sarah Palin's email. And frankly, he really didn't hack it. He simply got the password. And the way he got the password was he went to Yahoo and got, went to whatever it was, alaskagov.yahoo, or at Yahoo, and said, I forgot my password. And they said, oh, okay, well, we'll give you the password if you'll tell us the answers to these two or three questions. And the questions were things like, you know, where did you grow up, or where did you meet your husband, or what was the name of the high school you went to? And this guy said, well, it was Wasilla High, and I, you know, things like that. And it took him a couple, two or three tries, evidently. But the answers to the questions were things that were basically readily available, and with somebody who is relatively public. So what do you guys do when you've got a password for some site like that? Dave, you mentioned Gmail. You know, if I know your Gmail address, and I have to know it if I'm going to send you email there, I could go and get your password if I knew the answer to those questions. What do you do?
Well, first of all, I don't ever use Gmail or Ymail or any of the other public email systems. I use a hosted service with very tight security that offers exchange email services. It's low cost. It's worth every penny of it to keep it secure. Remember, you're doing business over this, and the fact that someone is can socially engineer their way into your password has to be a little frightening. For personal email, fine, use those services all you wish, but for professional email, go to the place you're going to get security, and I've always believed that.
Okay. So what about, anytime you use any web service that generates a user or a password for you, they have that reset function, and you have to use them. Your bank does that. Your airline does that. All of those things. How do you answer those questions? Anybody got any ideas?
Well, I think you have the opportunity to decline. I think there's some that you have to answer, but most of them you have the opportunity to just say, I don't want to use this. And then there's a warning, of course, that if you lose your password, that they won't be able to help you reset it. But that's one option anyway.
Sure. I've always been scared to death that somebody's going to find out my mother's maiden name and the last four digits of my Social Security number. Those aren't real difficult things I think you could figure that out from anybody with not a whole lot of work. So I get concerned about those. The whole idea of password management, until we get to true multi-factor authentication, in other words, you know, who you are, retinal or fingerprint, that sort of thing, what you have, some sort of a fob or a USB device or something, and what you know, and we're not there yet. Until we're there, we're stuck with password management. And I know a lot of people like, the RoboForm kind of an idea. Do you, what do you guys think of that solution for managing passwords?
Well, you know, we've recommended those type of products for a while, understanding we think they have some risk. In my NMGI business, we used RoboForms until we went to the Citrix password manager. And personally for our K2 teams, we're using Password Depot. The good news is both of those products can be kept on encrypted sticks. And, you know, I just looked while we were talking. I've got 187 passwords in my password manager. So clearly, if somebody could get to that, there could be some damage done across a number of sites that I've got secured that way. And frankly,
right.
I just don't have the wherewithal to even remember the common user IDs and passwords at this point. So I really would prefer the hardware-based multi-factor products, the RSAs of the world. There's some nice products out of Canada that I've reviewed and so forth. Another one out of Wisconsin we reviewed and so forth. But all of them tend to be a little tricky to install, take more IT support than I'd like, don't have enough Active Directory or LDAP or Citrix integration so you can really get a single user sign-on, but better than trying to do it any other manual way that we can think of right now.
Right. Right. Well, I had republished in the November issue. I republished a column that I wrote probably 5 years ago, and I've had it keeps coming back. It floats around on the internet, and I get thank you notes every once in a while from people saying this is just a wonderful idea. I'm not sure it's perfect, but let me real quickly run down what I think is a solution. I use what I consider a highly secure, in my case, it is 11 characters. It includes upper and lower case numbers and symbols and is complete nonsense. So I have 11 characters. To that, I add characters from either the program, in other words, the password for for a particular program, if it's password protected, the website, the machine, whatever it is. So if I happen to be signing on to Wells Fargo, I might take a letter from the second letter and the fifth letter of the name of the website and insert those into my otherwise nonsensical 11-digit password, so that becomes my password for Wells Fargo. But when I sign on to Merrill Lynch, I have exactly the same password, which is all nonsense, 11 digits. And instead of taking digits, characters from Wells Fargo, I would take characters from Merrill Lynch. Maybe in my particular case, it's the first and the last letter of the website name, or the first two, or the second and fourth, or whatever, however you want to set that up. But that way, to me, I have a single password to remember, but no website, no program, no machine uses the same password as any other. So although it's the same to me, it's different to everybody else. So reactions to that?
Sounds like a reasonable thing to do to me. For me, I mean, I use a slightly different variant of that, but I too use a basic, fairly strong upfront, and then change the last four depending on the site I'm on. I don't use the same scheme you do, but very similar.
Right, similar idea. And I, for me, that works for now, because I'm concerned about the password depot approach, because I don't know what happens when I'm out and my luggage is stolen and I don't have I don't have my little jump drive anymore. It's gone, and I need access. And so if I have something that is in my memory as opposed to in my pocket, I have a solution. And I don't know, it kind of flies against the multi-factor authentication, but it kind of works for me. So Randy, you wrote again another great article, column in the upcoming issue, and you talked about it. You did kind of a tool update, and you talked about a whole bunch of different things that I thought were each good enough to talk about at some length. But you talked about things like Smart Vault and Bill.com and ProfitSense and Illumin, all kinds of different things out there. Introduce that for us a little bit. Pick out maybe a couple of those, and let's talk about them for a few minutes.
Yeah, in this particular article and the evolution of the market, this has really been driven by about two or three lines of reasoning. One, the evolution and continued interest in software as a service, or SaaS. So part of the tools are truly web-based products that are multi-tenanted and multi-user and so forth, and fulfill a particular function well. The other part of it was the thinking that there are products that are very mainstream, QuickBooks being a good example there, that have a lot of third-party products that are extending and enabling those products to work, and that all of those, from a practitioner's perspective, are either good for their practice, their clients, or both, depending on what they are, and that's where a number of these tools fit in. So, you know, the goal here was to try to think through a number of products just to make sure that people had were aware that they'd been introduced and their fundamental capabilities. So let's start with, Bill.com as an example. This product, which was developed by René Lacerte and his team, is intended to be a payables management system. It will get extended, I think, over time to receivables and some other things, but it truly is a workflow slash approval and an integration into accounting product. The idea here is that practitioners can see their clients' information with permissions, and likewise be able to read the data or the summary of the transactions into different accounting softwares, QuickBooks being one of them, but other mid-market products also being an example. And sure, these products, in many, many cases, are free to practitioners, and they're relatively small or low cost to end users themselves. I think Bill.com, for example, is like $15 per user per month. So, again, I don't know that we can implement systems so easily and so rapidly as some of these types of tools are enabling us. You know, so a second one of the tools in this category was Smart Vault. You know, Eric Pulaski and his team basically developed a paperless system which is elegantly integrated into QuickBooks. Same basic types of philosophy where practitioners can use this for their own in-house work and keep track of, you know, documents related to that system, integrate in terms of transactions, and it can be used by clients as well. And again, a relatively low cost of entry for this type of product. So,
one of the things, Randy, one of the things that so impresses me about that Smart Vault thing is almost as an afterthought, they added the ability to, in a setting, basically, to say, once I'm done, tying my documents to QuickBooks, once I'm done and ready to close my QuickBooks, my local QuickBooks application, I'm going to automatically send a backup copy of that to Smart Vault, basically to the web, and have that available. And then when the practitioner, for example, opens their Smart Vault, they can say, well, I now want to work on client A's instance, and they download that copy. So while it is not QuickBooks on the web, it seems to me that it has all of the benefits with none of the overhead.
Yes, and in fact, it is so simple and elegant to use, I think it may become a methodology of choice as soon as people figure out it's there, and particularly for firms that have a fair bit of write-up in their practice that deal with QuickBooks clients directly, this could be a very elegant way to exchange files and to be looking at similar documentation in question rather than scanning it in and faxing it and emailing it and all those techniques. So, another tool of this class of interesting product that clearly has a market position might be the Business Analyst out of Wisconsin. Ted C. and his team basically came up with a product that does a very gorgeous job of doing business valuation using multiple methodologies, that has profitability analysis. It has a little bit of modeling for merger acquisition and a few other things that are particularly interesting. And when I was thinking about this particular tool and thinking about the current economic conditions, one of the highest value adds that we can bring to our clients is just direct business advice, how to run the business more profitably, how to look for, things inside the business, or if we're at that point that we're ready to transition out and really want to get fair valuations. This tool is one of the best that I've seen in this particular category. Again, it happened to be a software as a service tool, very minimal setup, and very sophisticated calculations sitting behind the product. So, you know, another small tool of the class of good information for clients, good information for in-consuming industry businesses as well, might be the ProfitSense tool. This tool from the company SageWorks has done, you know, a very nice job of expanding their original scope, where they now handle risk analysis, for example. They have key performance indicators inside the product. They actually can do a pretty nice job of producing their original vision of verbiage or English-like financial statements. And Brian Hamilton and his team there have done an exceptionally good job of making the product more usable across more industries, not-for-profits, banking, and so forth. But again, a software as a service tool that takes very little effort from a practitioner side, and I believe delivers a fairly high value add for boardroom reporting, understanding what's going on in the businesses, and so forth.
You know, Randy, it occurred to me as you're describing those, the common factor in all of those, besides being they're all SaaS offerings, is that they all slice things very differently from anything else. They really don't have a direct competitor. They do things so much differently than anyone else that I've watched practitioners at conferences, at trade shows, walk past the, for example, the Smart Vault booth and say, "Oh, I know, you know, I know that's just document management,"
yep.
and not stop. But then when they do stop and they look at it, they have this huge aha moment, and they go, "Oh, I didn't. What I thought you were is not at all what you are. It's a much, much different thing." Do you see that certainly with the Bill.com thing?
Your insight here is exactly right, because I'm actually very hard-pressed to name any viable competitor to all the tools that we've named up to this point. You know, one more example might be the iLumen tool, which, again,
right. If
you have not looked at iLumen in the last 60, maybe a little longer, 180 days compared to what you might have seen in the past, it's a completely different type of product than it was in the past. They still have what they have in the past, but they now have much more firm analysis. So if you're trying to mine your client base for additional opportunity, additional services that you can provide, or if you're trying to manage profitability across multiple locations and so forth, the iLumen reporting tool has some exceptionally deep data mining capability that's actually, again, pretty simplistic to run. But, you know, those first few tools that we've talked about being SaaS only tell about half the story, because the other side of the story is the extension tools. Some of them will be SaaSable, some hostable, some run in-house, but to name very specifically, you've got a tool like a BizNet for financial reporting, or a MySys, which is a very, very fine entry-level manufacturing product for QuickBooks and about seven other products, or a Fishbowl, which, you know, is not only a Linux-based capable inventory system that can be used single user at no charge, but can be also integrated tightly into QuickBooks, and is a very high-end inventory system, even probably stronger than the Velocity that's built into the QuickBooks Enterprise. And then you've got other very interesting time and billing products like Shafat's QuickBooks, BillQuick. Into QuickBooks. You know, so the BillQuick product not only integrates to QuickBooks, but also Office Accounting and so forth. And then you've got players like the Wasp Barcode folks or Avalira. And as I'm kind of naming down through these classes of products, what I'd want the listeners to think about in here is that it used to be that we would have products that were outgrown, or that we would try to work around our systems with spreadsheets and so forth. And I think as either the economy is tough or our users are getting more sophisticated, just adding a little bit of functionality with some of these third-party products are exceptionally valuable to the business. I think they can be exceptionally valuable to the practitioners. And I think that, a practitioner can go to an industry business and say, I think I've got a value-add proposition for you here that is particularly strong, and here's the reasons that you should do those things.
Right. Well, go ahead.
Well, and the good news is that most of these vendors have a very good offering for CPA firms. In some case, no cost. In other case, minimal cost. So whether it's a well-organized program like Intuit's ProAdvisor or Sage's SN or Microsoft's MPAN or SAP's Business One CPA or Avalara's PAN or most of the products have a strong understanding of the value of CPA firms and the relationship to their clients.
Exactly. So these are all interesting tools, and I certainly appreciate you pulling them all together and putting them in one spot. And encourage the listeners to take a real hard look at your column when the November issue arrives. The interesting thing again I see on these things, Randy, is how uniquely each of these products actually operate. I was able at Tech Plus to introduce Eric Pawlowski from Smart Vault to Renee Lassert from Bill.com, who, if you look at those two products, they are not competitors, but in some fashion they each do a little bit of the same thing. In other words, if you used one, you would not use the other, but you would solve different problems with each of them. And it was fascinating to watch these guys look at the other product with, in both cases, very with great admiration, saying, "Wow, what you've done is really, really cool." And and pretty amazed. Very, very interesting kind of stuff.
And see, I think this is actually a little bit of a foreshadowing of the future, because I believe these tools built properly as building blocks can be linked together by businesses, and I think their vision will keep that way. And I think they're going to be enabled by things like Microsoft.NET technologies or Java-based technologies and so forth, and the end users will begin to pick specific applications that can be linked together that allow them to do things that were not possible by themselves.
But
the most important point of the column and the products were this thinking that, you really do need to stop and look at these particular products. There's some more I could have named, but really for space limitations didn't.
Sure.
But realistically, these were all unique with very few viable competitors in the same slot. And that the value to you as an industry CPA or as a public practitioner to your clients, if you had these in your toolkit, you would be of much better service.
Right. Yeah. All interesting things to take a look at. And that, for example, the Smart Vault product has about a 3 or 4 page. Advertorial in this upcoming issue, just because their story and what they're doing is so unique that they don't have the opportunity to say, we're like those guys except a little bit different, because they're very different. That's kind of true of all of those. So, Randy, thank you for that column. It kind of leads us into our last topic, and I want to make sure we get over there and that we talk about this a little bit, because all of those products, or virtually all of the products that we talked about, were software as a service, which makes the browser a lot more important tomorrow than it was yesterday, I think. And Dave, you talked a little bit about browsers in your upcoming column, And I know you have strong opinions. So share with me a little bit your thoughts on browsers. What's your browser? What's your default on your machines, Dave?
I'll be honest, my default is Internet Explorer, and I'll tell you why. For a run-of-the-mill browser guy or accountant who's not a geek like us, Internet Explorer is going to do virtually everything they want it to do, and I say virtually. There are things about Internet Explorer I don't like, but with each generation, they seem to go out and look at the best features of all their competitors and then steal them and incorporate them. So slowly, Internet Explorer, you know, we went 10 years with basically one web browser, and that was Internet Explorer. Now we've got Firefox, we've got Opera, we've got
Chrome,
of course, the new Chrome from Google, each of which has a lot of advantages and disadvantages. Let me say first, Internet Explorer does have some significant disadvantages. In every test that I've seen, it runs slowest of all the browsers. And it's got security problems that are well known. When you're on top of the heap, the hackers tend to go after you, and they have done so with Internet Explorer. So you have to keep up with the security patches, and it is not perfect. If you wanted a perfect browser, again, most if you're just looking at the hard data and the speed tests and the other tests, it's probably going to be Opera. Very fast. It's got some nice new features like, you know, being able to sync your bookmarks among PCs that are on its service, its hosted service. There are some sites that are not fully compatible with Opera, but there are sites that are not fully compatible with Firefox as well. And here we're talking about PC-based computers because Mac, of course, has Safari, and Safari is an excellent browser for the Mac and also for mobile platforms increasingly. So among all of those, it's boy, pick whichever one you like, but if you don't want to mess with it at all, you're relatively safe just staying with Internet Explorer. Now, do you want to comment on that before we talk about Chrome? Because I have real issues with Chrome.
Well, I end up doing exactly what you do, Dave. My default is IE8. I am using IE8. I have Firefox. I have Chrome on my machine. But my problem with them is these browsers identify themselves to websites, and you know, for example, if I want to use Intuit's QuickBooks Online, it looks at me when I try to sign on, and it says, "Oh, you're not using Internet Explorer. I won't let you sign on." That's fairly common to end up locked out of sites. And I understand there are ways to spoof other browsers from Chrome and Firefox and things, but you know that becomes it's a compatibility issue for me. But I mean, after you've used Chrome a couple of times and you understand how blazingly fast a browser can be, it's actually kind of disheartening to go back to IE.
No, and I agree with you, Greg. There are if you're going to use Internet Explorer, I really recommend they've got a relatively new function called In Private that helps to do a little better job of protecting who you are online, and that brings me to Chrome. Chrome is a stripped-down browser. It is fast. There's no question about it. They have bypassed a lot of the rigmarole, and it really bypasses all of the frame kind of stuff to just get you to a website, and the websites that can work with it very easily, it does an amazing job with. Here's my problem. Google makes its money one way, because you always have to look at the money. And Google makes their money by collecting your personal data and selling it to advertisers. So you get some funky stuff with Chrome, like there's no ad blocking. Go figure. But the other thing is, and they claim that they're not going to sell your very personal data that's identifiable to you, but I just rebel at the idea that somebody's following me everywhere I go, tracking it, collecting that information. When you're just using Google's search engine, they're kind of limited in how far they can track you and what they can do. When you're using their browsers, all kinds of red flags go off for me because they are collecting that information, and they are going to pass it on, and I don't like that. What do you think?
You know, I have some of the same concerns, not as much as you do. Brent, Brent, what's your browser of choice? Oh, we may have lost Brent.
Good heavens, I put him to sleep.
Oh, okay.
There's a technical issue there, huh?
Yeah, we did lose Brent. He got mad and went away, I guess. So, Randy, let's wrap this up with what are your thoughts on browsers? What are you using?
Well, you know, I like you, Greg, am using IE8, and I'm doing that primarily because of compatibility with sites. You know, the new Firefox browser, clearly, a much nicer browser, and I will tell you that most of the people that I know that are 30 years old and below use Firefox. And, you know, the new Firefox 3.1, even quicker than the Firefox 3.0. And our experience on Chrome is similar, very, very fast browser. But, at this point, with website incompatibilities, it's just not worth messing with from my perspective of using the alternate products for now.
Sure.
In the long haul, though, I think, having the two strong competitors and more, because obviously there are more like Opera and Safari and so forth,
right.
I think having those multiple strong competitors certainly helps push Microsoft. And again, you'd keep watching the Firefox market share just inching up and inching up. That browser may continue to become dominant enough that all the sites will intentionally test and work with Firefox as well as IE8.
Right. Well, I really believe, Brent, we're just finishing up here as we're talking about browsers. We are all reluctant IE8 users. Is that kind of where you fall?
Yeah, that's exactly where I am, and I was listening just fine. It's just that when I went to talk, there was nothing coming through. So I'm using IE8, but of course I've tried all of the other culprits, and I appreciate Dave's analysis of the privacy issue. It doesn't surprise me at all that Google is putting their profit motive first, as probably they should do.
Sure. Well, it just seemed to me that with the move toward all of the software as a service things, that the browser, which used to be, pretty much inconsequential. It was just really didn't matter a whole lot. We didn't think about it all that much. How do we get to a website? It was just there. I think that browser is, if it's not the OS of tomorrow, at least it's getting to be a lot more important. And it's something for us to continue to watch.
You bet.
So guys, we have burned our allotted time almost to excess. We're a little bit beyond, so we do need to wrap up. I want to remind everybody that we are recording our next Tech to Go episode 23 on November 19th at 11:30 a.m. Eastern Time, and we'd invite all of you to stop by and join us. Take a look at our show notes at cpatechadvisor.com, and we're done for the day. Mr. McClure, thank you again for your time and your cheerful disagreement.
As always, Greg.
Well, I appreciate your perspective. And Randy, thanks so much for taking time this morning. Are you traveling today, or are you home?
Nope, I am enjoying home. In fact, I've been home most of the month of October, but head out tomorrow to beautiful Charleston, South Carolina.
Oh, enjoy that. I have been out since Friday, and I'm on my way over to California. I'm in Phoenix today and San Diego tomorrow for some Cal Society stuff, and then up to Palm Springs for the CCH Users Conference starting in next weekend. So I'm out for a while, and I've got myself acclimated to Pacific time, Brent.
Well, good for you. I will see you at the CCH Users Conference.
All right, good. Well, looking forward to seeing you there. Brent, thanks again so much for your time. This has been episode 22 of the CPA Technology Advisors Intersection Live Series, Tech to Go. Thanks again, guys. Have a great day. This has been Tech to Go, episode 22, Outlook, Passwords, Tools, and Browsers.
For more information about the CPA Technology Advisors' other podcast programs, webcasts, and our e-newsletter, visit www.cpatechadvisor.com. To ask questions or leave comments about our podcasts, call 800-456-0864, extension 2106, or tune into future episodes where you're able to ask questions live via TalkShoe.com.